You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the Claremont killings.
Right, well, these were crimes, you'll remember, that left an entire state in the grip of a murder mystery. Indeed, it wasn't just WA. I remember being a young woman over here on the eastern seaboard at the time, and what happened in Perth really hit home.
This is where it all began.
That's right, this is Claremont. This is where our three victims went missing from in 1996 and 1997.
Sarah was the first?
Sarah Spears disappeared in 1996. Jane Rimmer, she went also in 1996. And Kira Glennon, she went missing in 1997.
Police believe there may still be someone who can supply information about Sarah's disappearance. And the hunt for Sarah becomes a much wider crime investigation when just 5 months after she disappeared, a second young woman goes missing from Claremont.
And Jim, there were similarities, weren't there?
Yes, there was. I mean, both victims were attractive young women. They had been out socialising with their friends in the Claremont area. It was really at the end of their night out, and they were really trying to get home. And they were walking alone.
I came across this case in 2018 and have been following it ever since. This case actually takes place in Australia, and I truly believe it should have garnered much more national attention than it did. This was the longest-running, most expensive, and largest manhunt in Australia to date. There is so much we can learn from this case. There's also multiple victim stories that deserve to be told. Perth is the capital of Western Australia, and it sits along the Swan River where it meets the southwest coast. Sandy beaches line the suburbs, and it's most known for King's Park and Botanic Gardens. It's also known for being the most isolated city in the world because there's the Indian Ocean on one side and the outback on the other side, which makes this city completely surrounded by nature. It's also known as the Education City. It's said that students in Perth have the best quality of education in all of Australia. There's crystal clear waters to surf with plentiful nightlife, and some of the best festivals are held in Perth, Australia. Live music venues and comedy venues are year-round, so it's a great city for entertainment. Perth seems to have a little bit of everything for everyone. Claremont is a western suburb of Perth, a very affluent area in the 90s, and was best known for its nightlife. With many cafes, restaurants, hotels, and nightclubs, it was the place to be, and many would flock to hang out with friends on weekend nights to celebrate holidays like Australia Day and St. Paddy's Day. However, the booming nightlife scene would drastically change in 1997 once the city would begin to suspect there was a predator hunting the streets of Claremont for young women to snatch in the darkness, never to be seen again. The first known victim would be a young girl named Sarah Spears. Sarah was the youngest child of parents Don and Carol, born in Western Australia. Sarah was said to be very involved with her family, very kind, very affectionate, and always thinking of others. Sarah's family said that Sarah, even as a teenager, was very thoughtful and would always honor her commitments. Her father would go on to later say that Sarah was very well-versed in personal safety and was not ignorant at all to city dangers. Sarah grew up in the country away from the city pace. She was close to her sister growing up and attended boarding school in Perth. After she graduated, she attended secretarial school until landing a receptionist position with an engineering consult company. While Amanda, Sarah's older sister, and Sarah were said to have very different personalities, it is also said by their father, Don, that Sarah and Amanda got along very well, never had an argument that he knew of, and they were always there for one another. So it was no surprise to the family that at age 18, Sarah and Amanda would have an apartment together in Perth. Her parents would often make the drive up from the country to visit the girls on the weekend. The last time Don and Carol would see Sarah, they had come up for the weekend in mid-January 1996 to discuss plans with the girls about how they planned to celebrate Amanda's upcoming 21st birthday. Looking back, Don had this nagging feeling about leaving that weekend. He just didn't want to leave his girls. Don remembers, as the weekend ended, pulling out of the driveway of Sarah and Amanda's flat, suddenly stopping and getting out of the car once more to hug his girls before getting back in the car with his wife and heading back to their home in the country. As he pulled away, watching them wave goodbye in his rearview mirror, he kept thinking to himself, "I hope they stay safe until the next time I can see them again." That was the last time he'd ever see Sarah. January 26, 1996, the Australian Day holiday. Sarah and her friends had made plans to attend a picnic dinner at an open-air concert in Kings Park. Later in the evening, as the sun was starting to set, Amanda's sister comes and picks up Sarah and her friends and drives them to the Ocean Beach Hotel in Cottesloe. A bit later, Sarah and her friends were ready to go and head to the next location for the night. So Amanda picked them up once again and drove them to Claremont so they could go to the Bayview nightclub and have some more fun celebrating the holiday. Amanda remembers Sarah was in a great mood, and when she dropped her and her friends off at the club, before Sarah walked away, she leaned in the car and gave her sister a hug and a kiss, thanking her for the ride. That would be the last time Amanda would see her little sister as she watched her walk into the club. Normally, Amanda would have returned at the end of the night to pick up Sarah, but Amanda was attending university classes and working a part-time job and was so exhausted. So she asked Sarah if she could catch a cab home that night so she could catch up on some sleep. Around 2 a.m., Sarah tells her friend she's ready to go home. It seems the rest of the group, however, is not. Sarah decides to head out on her own. As she is leaving the club, she stops and chats with the bouncer she recognizes as a friend of hers and her sister's. The bouncer asks how her sister is and how she's getting home. She tells him she's going to walk down to the corner to the phone booth and phone a cab to pick her up. Sarah says goodbye to the bouncer and starts walking down towards the corner of Stirling Road and Stirling Highway. At 2:06 a.m., Swan Taxi Service gets a call from Sarah asking them to pick her up and take her to the suburb of Mossman Park. This isn't in the direction of the apartment she shares with her sister. Instead, it seems she decided to stay the night at one of her friend's flats that she attended the open-air concert in Kings Park with earlier that day. They had told her that at the end of the night, if she wanted to crash there, she was welcome to do that, since it was cheaper to take a taxi there than all the way back to her apartment in South Perth. Based off the information from the taxi service, it seems like that was her exact plans for that evening. Just as Sarah is walking out of the phone booth and approaching the corner of Stirling Road and Stirling Highway to wait for her cab, three young men in a car pass her and stop at the red light at the same intersection. They notice a pretty young girl standing there by herself, and soon there's headlights behind him. The guys in the car begin to go through the intersection and notice that the headlights behind them are not moving through the intersection too. One of the three guys in the car notices this and looks back, asking the other two guys if they should go back and check on her. As they are now rounding the corner, they still don't see the headlights of the car that was behind them. They consider for a moment going back, but then as a group decide that it's very unlikely that a girl would have trouble in the Claremont area. Back then, Claremont was a very nice suburb, a very lively area, and people were not just vanishing off the streets, so they decided to continue with their night, driving away from the intersection. At 2:09 a.m., the Swan Taxi arrives at the corner of Stirling Road and Stirling Highway, looking for Sarah, but she is nowhere to be found. The taxi driver made it to the light and looked around. He was at the intersection where Sarah was just standing moments ago, but she was not there. He looked up at the phone booth to make sure that she wasn't waiting in there. In fact, there wasn't a soul in sight, so the taxi driver left. It wouldn't be until Monday around 8:15 a.m. that anyone would realize that Sarah was missing. While Sarah wouldn't return home to her apartment Saturday morning or Sunday day, that wasn't out of the ordinary. Amanda just figured that she had decided to stay out with friends for the weekend, especially since it was a holiday weekend. Now it was a Monday morning, and since Amanda had yet to hear from Sarah all weekend, she had decided to call Sarah's work and just check in with her to make sure she was okay. When Amanda rung her work, it was about 8:15, and Sarah was always at work on time. So when she called her work, only to find that she wasn't there yet, Amanda began to worry. Sarah was a very responsible person. This was completely out of character for her. Right away, Amanda begins to call all of Sarah's friends, asking them if she was with them and when was the last time that they had seen her. The panic began to set in after all her friends stated that the last time they had seen her was late Friday night when she left the club on her own to catch a cab. That's when Amanda made the decision to reach out to her parents and let them know that she hadn't seen or heard from Sarah since she dropped her off at the club Friday night, and none of her friends had seen or talked to her since she left the club around 2 a.m. Right away, her parents were alarmed, knowing this just wasn't like Sarah, to go this long without communicating with friends and family. Sarah's parents tried to think of every reason why she wouldn't be in contact over the weekend with everyone, or with anyone for that matter. That's when the deep dread started to sink in that something was very wrong. That Monday, Sarah's parents decided to phone the police and report Sarah missing. Due to the nature of Sarah's sudden disappearance and after speaking with Sarah's family, the initial officers decided to get investigators involved with this case quickly, and it was taken over by Major Crime Squad. As it was very apparent to all involved that this was not the average missing person case. Flyers were quickly made and distributed around Claremont and Perth, featuring not only Sarah's picture, but a description of the outfit she was wearing that night. The description is as follows: a pair of beige shorts, a light-colored shirt, and unique shoes. Beige in color with a chunky heel and a flower cutout at the top. I will be posting pictures on my Sipping on Some Crime page related to this case so you can see the shoes I'm talking about. They are like the shoes I remember a lot of the girls wearing in the 90s in school. 35,000 flyers end up being distributed by friends and family around Perth. Volunteers, along with family members, start walking the streets around Claremont's busy nightlife district, asking fellow patrons if they have seen Sarah or if they had seen her Friday night, and if so, what do they remember? Police decide to release a public appeal to everyone in the area that night at the club to come forward and tell them if they remember seeing anything in particular, anything out of sorts, if they can remember seeing Sarah. Investigators come out to the public also asking drivers that were at the intersection of Sterling Road and Sterling Highway around 2:06 a.m. to come forward and speak to police. The three men in the car that night come forward, telling investigators about what they saw that night as they passed Sarah at the intersection. Investigators now know there was another vehicle out there that night that never came through the intersection that also passed Sarah standing on the road that night. Investigators asked that driver to come forward and provide more information. That driver never comes forward. Hundreds of people call in to report a tip. And so now, investigators are trying to sort and categorize each tip coming in and follow up on every single one of them. While investigators are sorting hundreds of tips, Dawn and Carol are at home receiving nonstop phone calls all night and day from psychics claiming that they have information on the whereabouts of Sarah. While Carol stayed home waiting by the phone for investigators or Sarah to hopefully phone home, Dawn would follow every single psychic tip. Dawn and Carol were so desperate for answers and just wanted to bring their daughter home and were willing to follow any lead. These psychics would tell Dawn they knew where Sarah's remains were, and he would drive straight there without hesitation. Dawn would at times be walking through fields, treading through lakes, and in swamplands, even in the middle of the night. Dawn followed every single lead from the psychics until he just couldn't take it anymore. Both Dawn and Carol got to the point where they had to take a step back and continue to allow the investigators to do their job. Every single day, they held up hope that Sarah would just come home and walk through their front door and this nightmare would end. Sarah's remains have never been found to this day. While investigators are still looking into every lead for Sarah's disappearance, just 5 months later, another young, beautiful girl would vanish off the streets of Claremont. Jane Rimmer, the youngest child in her family, was born 1973 to parents Jenny and Terry Rimmer in Shenton Park, a suburb of Perth, about a 10-minute drive from Claremont. Jane was a very quiet, calm child when she was younger. As she got older, she started to show her fun-loving side. In high school, friends would say that Jane was a very well-liked girl that hung out with the popular kids. She was that surfer chick who spent much of her time down at Cottesall Beach. She was very ambitious and goal-oriented, and by her teen years had already set her mind on working with children when she grew up. Jane accomplished just that. At the age of 23, Jane had her own apartment and was working with children just like she always wanted. Even though she had moved out of her childhood home, Jane would often show up at mom and dad's Saturday morning with a basket of laundry to do and sit and chat with her parents about her week. She also tended to drop in weeknights after work and chat with her mother about her day. Jane's father just thought the sun shone from her. He said that she had grown into such a beautiful lady. Her father would always describe her as bubbly in interviews. Friends say that she was just a smiley, loving, caring person. Her friend, Linda, said that Jane's personality matched her face, that you could see her goodness just shining out of her, that she was just a really good person. On Saturday, June 8, 1996, Jane and her friend Linda had made plans to meet up with friends at the Ocean Beach Hotel in Cottesall, the same hotel Sarah had been the night she disappeared. Jane and her friends ate dinner there, had a few drinks, and decided as a group to head over to the Continental Hotel in Claremont. The Continental Hotel was a very popular night spot for young people that would meet up for drinks and dancing on a weekend night out. Linda remembers after they arrived at the Continental, they all went upstairs where the dance floor was, hung out dancing with one another until around 11:30 p.m. At this point, they decided they have had enough of the Continental and would like to go to another popular nightclub, the Bayview. Jane really didn't want to go to the Bayview. She hated it, but decided to tag along since all the other girls wanted to go. Since the club was within walking distance, the girls just decided to walk over together. When the group arrived at the Bayview, there was a long line to get in, and at this point, some of the girls were just ready to call it a night. So as a group, they decided that they'd just all grab a taxi and head home. As the group of girls began walking down to get a cab, they noticed that Jane is kind of lagging behind them. Jane tells them that she really isn't ready to go home, and they could go on without her, that she was going to stay and hang out. The friends decided they'll go grab a cab and just swing back by Jane on their way out and grab her. When the friends come back around and try to get Jane to go with them, she's not ready to go home. She insists on staying behind, telling her friends she'll see them later. The following day, Trevor and Jenny, Jane's mom and dad, are waiting for Jane to show up for their weekly Sunday lunch. And when she doesn't show, they become concerned. Trevor and Jenny attempt calling their home, and there is no answer. So they decide to head over to her apartment and check in on her. It wasn't like Jane to miss their Sunday lunches, and especially not to call and check in. When they arrive at her apartment, it is apparent that she has not been home. At this point, they decided to call the police and report her missing. Right away, the police put together similarities with Jane and Sarah's disappearance. The fact that both girls looked very similar, were relatively the same age, and had both seemed to have mysteriously vanished from the same area, investigators just knew they had to be connected. Investigators decided it was best to combine search efforts for both Sarah and Jane. Now they had two women missing, two women who were known to both be very reliable and responsible. It doesn't seem like investigators even considered that these girls decided to just walk away from their lives. So many times we hear that it takes time for investigators to jump to action because they always seem to say, well, they are adults and they have the right to show up or not show up somewhere. But not in this case. Investigators create a task force called Macro, focused on finding Jane and Sarah and hopefully preventing another young woman from vanishing off the streets in Claremont. Jane's family and friends hit the street distributing flyers to people and businesses in the area in hopes someone would recognize her and lead them to some answers as to where she had gone. One of the local papers at the time picked up the story of Jane's disappearance and began inserting a flyer with Jane's picture and information in each paper they sold, hoping to reach a broader audience. Investigators hold a piece of evidence close and don't release it to the press or the public for years to come in Jane's case. They have a video of Jane standing outside the Bayview Club, and she's at the edge of the camera view by the street. You can see her smiling and having a brief interaction with someone who's not completely in view of the camera, and his back is turned towards the camera. He's taller than Jane with what looks like dark hair. This interaction is very short, and the man walks out of view, and Jane goes back to leaning on a pole, looking around at the other people on the sidewalks around her. You can see Jane's big, beautiful personality even in this short clip. Investigators say they interviewed everyone seen on film around Jane that night, but that they never knew who the man who briefly interacted with her was. They do eventually release this to the public, asking the person whose back is to the camera to come forward. But just like the person driving the car that night of Sarah's disappearance, they never come forward. A few months would go by with no sightings of either Sarah or Jane. Both of the girls' loved ones would continue to search for them. Both families would come to local news stations pleading for the public's assistance, and police would continue searching for the girls and any clues that would lead them to what happened to them in those early hours on the streets of Claremont. Investigators were perplexed. How had these women just vanished? It was becoming increasingly clear to the police and the local media that they possibly had someone stalking the streets in the late hours, preying on young women they found alone and vulnerable. There would be no break in the case until Saturday, August 3rd, 1996, when a family decided to go on a weekend drive about 40 kilometers or 25 miles from south of Perth and decide to stop and pick wildflowers. Tammy, her husband, and children decided to pull over by a huge field. It was a beautiful day and the perfect spot to look for wildflowers. As they were walking about, Tammy spots some lilies, and as she's bending down to pick them up, she notices a body in the grass at her feet. Tammy stood frozen in fear for a moment. Her husband could see the look on her face, and he came running, asking her what was wrong. Tammy just said, she's in there. Her husband said, who's in there? But all Tammy could get out was, she's in there. Her husband looked and saw the young girl's body lying in the grass. He grabbed Tammy's arm and said, let's go. We have to alert the police. But Tammy couldn't leave her. She felt anger bubbling inside of her. She told her husband to take the kids and get to the police. Tammy refused to leave this young girl alone. Tammy waited with her until her husband returned with the police. Later, Tammy would tell investigators that she was just so angry for the young girl, and the thought of leaving her alone there was just too much. Investigators were able to ID the body as Jane Rimmer. The police went to work investigating the scene and notifying Jane's family that they had found her remains. Trevor Rimmer is quoted in an interview saying that they were thankful for the 23 years that they had with Jane and that whoever did this could not take that away. Now with the discovery of Jane's remains and evidence pointing to a possible serial killer, police decided to launch a nationwide manhunt to track down this killer before he had a chance to strike again. Unfortunately, 9 months later, there would be another victim. Kira Glennon was a 27-year-old lawyer who was full of life. Kira had just recently returned from a backpacking trip from around the world. She had come home to continue her studies, be a bridesmaid in her sister's wedding, and had just started working back at her old law firm. Even though she was traveling for a few years, when she returned home, she was welcomed right back into her wide circle of friends. Kira was very bright. She spoke fluent Japanese and was a feisty girl with a fun-loving spirit. Her father said she was a resourceful, strong-willed girl who had an eagerness for life. Friday, March 14, 1997, Kira decided to go out for drinks after work with coworkers. Around 11 p.m., her and a few coworkers decided to head to the Continental Hotel in Claremont for more drinks and conversation. It's just a few days before St. Patrick's Day, so the hotel is packed. Kira separates herself from the group, chatting with different people in the hotel bar. About 20 minutes later, she walks up to the group, grabs her jacket that she left with one of the coworkers, and walks out the front of the hotel. A group of men waiting at the bus stop on Sterling Highway noticed Kira walking by herself towards her home in Mossman Park. One of the men at the bus stop looked up and called out to her, telling her it is not safe to hitchhike at this hour. Kira responded with, "I'm fine, thank you," before waving them off as she kept walking down Sterling Highway. The guys continued on with their own conversation as Kira walked away, and a few minutes later, they look down the street and see Kira talking to someone in a light-colored car that had stopped on the side of Sterling Highway. The men at the bus stop go back to their conversations once again, and a few moments later, they look up and Kira is gone. It's hard to say in that time frame where the guys were looking away whether Kira got in the car or not, because there are other possible sightings of Kira further down Sterling Highway that night. Since the men at the bus stop don't witness her getting into the car and they cannot recall the make or model of the light-colored car, it's hard to say if that's when or how she was abducted. Saturday morning the following day, Kira's mother discovers that she hasn't made it home. Her mother decides to phone one of Kira's friends to see if possibly she'd stayed there the night before. That's when her friends inform her that Kira had left the hotel that night before by herself. Right away, her mother is concerned. It is not like Kira not to be home, so she called the police and reported her missing right away. Investigators just know, based on the information from the missing reports filed by Kira's mother, that she is connected to the disappearance of Sarah and Jane. The macro task force is frustrated and very concerned that they have yet to catch this person and believe they may have a serial killer on their hands. News stations and radio stations start playing safety warnings to warn young women in the Perth area of the dangers of a possible predator. The warnings tell women to stay in well-lit areas, not to be alone on the streets, and not to get into unmarked cars, and to be positive they are local cabs. The task force also posts an award for $250,000 leading to the information on who this predator is. Kira's father, Dennis Glennon, comes out in the news making a public appeal asking for help locating his daughter. The Glennon's home phone begins to ring night and day with calls from psychics. All the calls had the same thing, tips of where they believe that Kira's remains were and what they believe had happened to her. It was torment for Kira's family. Dennis starts a fund called the Secure Community Foundation. That's purpose is to help raise money for extra resources for the investigation, and it raises hundreds of thousands of dollars to be used towards tracking down this predator. 19 days after Kira's disappearance on April 3, 1997, in Perth's northern outskirts in the Ingleton area, a 24-year-old laborer is bushwalking near a sandy track. I had to look that up. Bushwalking means hiking, just side note. When he comes across a body, he immediately runs to alert his boss about what he came across and call the police.
Well, actually run down the road, came straight into my office, and he was, I could say, pretty well white as a ghost. Said he had found someone, didn't really know who it was, but someone that looked like a female. He was distraught. We had to put him on a chair, sit him down, get some water, because he was in a pretty bad way. I would say there was some shock.
The remains were identified as Kira Glennon. The investigators went to work securing the scene once again in hopes of finding clues that would lead them to the killer before he strikes once again. At this point, investigators call in an Australian profiler by the name of Minasani and a visiting American FBI profiler, Captain Codwell, and they work together to construct a character outline of the murderer for investigators. At this point, investigators hold on tight to the way each woman was killed. They know it's an important part to catching the killer and proving his guilt. They also hold on tight to the condition in which the bodies were found, as this too may lead to clues about the killer's personality and traits that only the killer would know and may help them one day in court. They took this investigation very seriously. They did not want any details about the murders leaked. Every officer on the task force had to sign a confidentiality agreement, and they could not even discuss this case amongst themselves, out in public, or around officers not on the task force. The only information that they released to the public about the killer is that the abductions of these women were carefully planned and controlled, that the killer was very organized. Police reported that he probably takes very good care of his vehicle and is most likely washing and parking this car somewhere after the disappearance of these women. Investigators go on to say that he most likely has a job, is very controlled, and enjoys driving. They believe he's a person with high anxiety and would be noticeably distressed after the murders occur and after the news of remains being found. After the discovery of Kira's remains is released to the public, over 2,000 tips a day start pouring into the police station. There are over 50,000 tips in a month alone. And it was so overwhelming for the task force and police to handle, they had to have a new database technology imported from the UK to help them sort tips coming in so that they could all be followed up by the most important first. The police publicly announced that there was a vehicle the night that Kira disappeared that was seen stopped and talking to her on Sterling Highway around midnight, and they would like that driver of that vehicle to come forward and speak with police. That person never comes forward. At this point, the police decide to publicly admit that they are looking for a serial killer. There had been speculation with Sarah and Jane by the media, but now they were admitting that they are indeed on the hunt for a serial killer in Perth in the Claremont area. The Macro Task Force was working hard to find who this predator was. They were canvassing the areas all three girls had disappeared from and were interviewing hundreds of cab drivers about the disappearance of these girls. They really focused on the cab since two of the women were said to have caught a cab before disappearing. While Kira was seen talking to someone in a car that possibly could have been a cab driver. There were many unlicensed cabs that were found during this investigation, and they did yield a few good suspects early on. The investigators had some information that they didn't share with the public, that being that both Kira and Jane's remains were disposed of in similar ways. Both bodies were driven 40 kilometers or about 25 miles from Perth, one north and one south. Both Jane and Kira had injuries to their neck, which looked like they were caused by a sharp puncture, and both remains were barely concealed where the killer had placed them. The Macro Task Force set out to find this now apparent serial killer, but it would take years. They started putting officers on the street into surveillance cars and people at the clubs and hotels that the girls had frequented and others in the area. That's when they would notice one man that seemed to continuously drive down the streets, down the same roads, over and over again at night, glaring at women on the street. So one 3 a.m. morning, they pulled him over. His name is Lance Williams. Lance Williams would become their first prime suspect in the disappearance of Sarah and the murders of Jane and Kira. The press got a hold of Lance Williams as a suspect, and they followed him and approached him constantly. Lance did speak to the press more than one time to explain that he was innocent of this accusation.
Public servant Lance Williams was once the prime suspect. In 1998, the Cottesloe man claims he was followed by police around the clock for 20 months, repeatedly arrested and interrogated for 14 hours at a time.
It's been very distressing, you know, and especially I actually went back to my parents because, you know, I needed some sort of, company.
So what was Lance's excuse for being out in the late night and driving around glaring at women? Lance told family and friends that he was out driving around looking at women because he was trying to protect them from what was already out there trying to hurt them. Family and friends stood by Lance's side saying that he would never harm anyone and that he only had good intentions. However, officers weren't buying it and they weren't convinced that Lance wasn't their guy. In 2004, shortly after the Australian Story had aired their episode looking into the Claremont murder investigation, Australians began demanding an outside investigation into the Macro Task Force. It had been too many years now, and they wanted answers. The Macro team was defiant at first, stating that they had multiple outside investigators come and look at what they were doing to make sure that they weren't missing anything. But after all the pressure in 2004, they did put together an outside team of investigators to look at all the evidence that had been collected by the Macro Task Force. They brought together a team of five experts. They included detective officers from Australia, a psychological profiler from Seattle, Washington, and two forensic scientists. This team's job was to look at every single piece of evidence that the Macro investigation had collected over the time and see if they could find anything new that could shed light on who this killer was. After the team was presented with every single piece of evidence and they spent time with it, they then got together and decided collectively what was something new that they could look at. They began discussing the possibility of looking into the fingernails that they had from each victim because of the amount of DNA evidence that could be lying in those fingernails. Something else they discussed was that they noticed there wasn't really much done about the fibers found on Kira and Jane's bodies. They wanted to do research into these fibers that weren't naturally found in Jane and Kira's environments because they believed that those could lead them in the direction towards who this killer is. This independent team found all sorts of physical evidence that they felt had not been followed up on or looked deeper into, while the Macro team felt they had done everything and followed every lead. These five independent reviewers would find even more than just physical evidence not being followed up on. But also, the psychological profilers strongly believed that these murders weren't the first offenses of this offender. She strongly believed that there had to be a pattern of other offenses leading up to these murders, and the Macro Task Force hadn't looked back at other instances in the area to see if they could possibly be connected to the escalation of these three victims. This team would bring together all the information they had collected on the investigation of the Macro team to the West Australian Police, and they decided to leave them with the recommendations of what they believe needed to be done to move forward in finding this predator and finally getting him off the streets. It seems that the West Australian Police took heed of what was said, but the investigation still moved so slowly. So shortly after the recommendation in 2004, the Macro team was disbanded, and the Special Crime Squad was formed, and they would take over the Claremont case. It would be another 4 years until 2008 when the Special Crime Squad was finally able to make a breakthrough in this case. They decided to start by re-examining all the forensic evidence records, and while going through all those records, they discovered that a lot of evidence had yet to be tested. In fact, it was up to 4,000 pieces of evidence that had not been forensically tested. Most frustrating was the fact that all these pieces had been collected and separated and were carefully taken and preserved to be tested, and they never were. The biggest piece of the untested evidence was a scraping of the left thumbnail of Kira Glennon that had been recovered at her autopsy and carefully preserved this whole time, but again, was never tested. When they ran that sample, they found two full DNA profiles in that sample. One was Kira Glennon's DNA profile, and the other was a full profile of an unknown male. After 12 years of investigation, they now had a full DNA profile of Kira's murderer. They decided to take that full male DNA profile and work backwards with it, just like the profiler had suggested in 2004. Investigators began looking back at previous incidents in the area, crimes that could lead up to possibly these murders. How many unsolved crimes as far as rapes or attacks did they have that they didn't look at and link to the possibility of this escalation? They submitted this full male DNA profile into their system, and they were able to connect it back to an unsolved rape in 1995. In 1995, one late night, a young girl, 17 at the time, was walking home in the streets of Claremont when a man grabbed her from behind. He threw a hood over her head, bound and gagged her, and threw her into his car. He then drove her to a nearby cemetery where she was brutally raped repeatedly. Then he let her go. The investigators in her case collected that DNA, and that case had gone unsolved. But now they were able to connect that whoever had attacked this young girl on her way home had also murdered Kira. They now knew that they had to go back and look at more cases. But now, and even back then, this wasn't an easy task. Like they stated in the Claremont case, alone there were 4,000 pieces of evidence categorized as exhibits of evidence that were attached to this case. They have thousands of cases with thousands of pieces of exhibits, so going back and looking at these cases isn't an easy task, and hoping to find that one piece that connects you to the case that you're looking at is even harder to accomplish. After this connection with Kira and the cemetery rape, again they seem to run out of leads, and movement stops in this case. Then in 2015, a local newspaper in Claremont decides to run the story about Kira, Jane, and Sarah's murder, and the disappearance now being connected to the fourth victim at the Katakurata Cemetery rape. This is something that the public didn't know and weren't aware of, so putting that out on the front page drove back home the pressure to get this case solved. Because now they knew that this predator had a fourth victim, and how many more were out there? How many more were yet to come? So putting this story back into the spotlight really helped push the investigation forward once again. That's when the investigation team started to make connections to this case in a town called Huntingdale, an hour away from Perth. back in the 1980s. It seems this predator that they were looking for had not just struck in the Claremont area, but they were now able to connect him to a different area. In 1988, a young woman staying at her parents' home in Huntingdale awoke in the middle of the night to an unknown man sitting on her back. He had his hand wrapped tightly around her mouth. She began to struggle and move and got herself free enough to shout for her father, who was in the bedroom next door to her. This unknown man then jumped off her back and ran out of the house before her father could get him. They realized quickly that he had left behind a cream-colored silk kimono that had the appearance that it had been used multiple times. Investigators decided in 2015 to take this kimono and test it. What led them to connect these cases, I don't know, but they were spot on. When they tested this kimono, the male DNA profile was an exact match to the male DNA profile under Kira's nails and from the cemetery rape victim. Now knowing that they had DNA that linked all three of these crimes together, they decided to look at other crimes in Huntingdale to see if they could possibly be linked. That's when they would discover another case in 1988 in Huntingdale, where a man dressed in a woman's nightgown had attempted to break into a home through a back sliding glass door. He had left four full fingerprints on that back sliding glass door. Those fingerprints would lead to a huge break in this case, because those fingerprints would match the same fingerprints left on the kimono in 1988. And those fingerprints would then turn up a match to the name Bradley Robert Edwards. At this time, Bradley Robert Edwards was a Telstar technician, a phone company out of Australia. Edwards would be the technician assigned May 7th, 1990 to come work on some phone line issues at the Hollywood Hospital. While on assignment to fix the phone lines there, Edwards would see a social worker, Wendy Davis, sitting at her desk quietly by herself. At that moment, he decided to come up behind her, gag her, and drag her backwards into the bathroom. Wendy would kick and fight so hard that all of a sudden, he would just let go of her and say, "Sorry, sorry," as he backed away in the corner. When the police came, they just charged him with simple assault. He would actually go to court and be put on probation. But the most messed up part about all of this would be that he was promoted on his job after this incident, which was reported to his boss. There's actually a 60-minute episode on Wendy Davis actually escaping him that day and everything that she went through from her perspective. How she felt when she explained to his company what happened and how he was still promoted, how it seemed like his boss was standing up for him, as well as how the police handled this attempted assault when it came to her. She talks about how she feels about these other victims that were hurt and how possibly had they taken her situation seriously from the beginning and looked at him more closely, then maybe these other women wouldn't have been hurt and some of these other women would still be alive today. I will put the link to that video on my page if you're interested. I highly recommend you going and watching it. At this point, investigators have a name, Bradley Robert Edwards. They have him linked to the cases in Huntingdale through the kimono and the fingerprints on the attempted break-in, as well as the rape in the cemetery through DNA. But they didn't have his DNA to link the full male DNA, proving the final link between all of these crimes. So investigators were now tasked with getting that DNA from Edwards to link it to the unknown DNA they had in the rape case and Kira's murder. Investigators began following Edwards, looking for their chance to obtain his DNA from something he discarded in public. One day, in 2016, undercover investigators followed Edwards into a movie theater, and there they sat behind him, watching him drink from a bottle of Sprite. When the movie ended, Edwards left the bottle in the cup holder of his seat and exited the theater. That's when investigators grabbed the bottle and took it into evidence. The DNA came back with a match to their unknown male profile. On December 22, 2016, police would arrest Edwards at his home in Kewdale, and the following day, he would officially be charged in the murders of Kira and Jane. Edwards would also be charged with the breaking and entering of an unlawful detention of an 18-year-old woman, which occurred in February 15th, 1988, where he left behind the kimono with his DNA, as well as he was charged with the rape of the young 17-year-old girl and the Katakura Cemetery rape in Claremont, which occurred February 12th, 1995. On February 22nd, 2018, charges of willful murder in the case of Sarah were added to this list of charges, even though they had yet to recover her body. News of Edward's arrest sent a shockwave of relief across Australia. There were reporters who saw crowds of people crying at hearing the news that he had finally been caught. Edward's first interrogations, he denied everything, telling investigators they had the wrong person. There are recorded interviews with the police interviewing Edward, starting with the day of his arrest in his home in Kewdale. In the video, Edwards can be seen sitting handcuffed on the floor in the hallway wearing a red polo shirt, looking disheveled. Detective Senior Sergeant Joe Maripati tells Edwards that he is being arrested for the murders of Kira Glennon, Sarah Spears, and Jane Rimmer. He explained he is also being charged with sexual assault of a girl and the Katakura Cemetery rape in 1995 and the assault of another teenage girl in her home in 1988 in Huntingdale. Edward's response was, "You gotta be joking me. What the fuck? I am innocent." Further in the video, you see Edwards sitting in the room among coat hangers, plastic bags, and cardboard boxes, looking up at the detective Maripati, bewildered as he says to him, "I'm just trying to process what's going on. I just want to ring my parents and let them know what's going on," quote unquote. Detective Maripati went to ask Edwards if he was familiar with the Claremont area. Edwards stated, "A little bit," but said he never went at night and never visited either the Club Bayview or the Continental Hotel. Edward does go on to admit that he had frequented the Ocean Beach Hotel in Cottesloe between 1990 and 1994 before he was married, which, if you remember, is where both Jane and Sarah began their night with friends drinking when they disappeared. In the video, Edwards continues to adamantly deny any involvement in the 1995 rape, saying he's never visited that cemetery at night, as well as denying the 1988 assault in Huntingdale. Edwards would continue these denials through all interviews with police investigators until the eve of his trial, November 2019, when he pled guilty to the rape charge and the assault charge from 1988. Edwards' trial would have no jury. His trial would be heard by a judge only due to the fact that the case had garnered so much media attention. The prosecution, represented by Carmel Barbagallo, opening statements to the court would be that Edwards' denial about the two assaults had cast serious doubt on his denials in regard to the alleged Claremont murders. The prosecution had quite the daunting task ahead of them. They had to represent evidence of crimes that had happened over a long period of time. They not only had his DNA link, but they also had to go back and show behaviors that would lead up to Edwards escalating into murder. The DNA evidence would be argued by the defense. Edwards' defense team would say that those critical fingernails that had contained the evidence for this case were possibly cross-contaminated at the pathology lab. His defense team would bring up examples of this instance where this actually happened, pointing out that sometimes their own scientists get their own DNA cross-sampled into some of these evidence samples, trying to represent that this is a completely possible explanation on how Edwards' DNA was matched. The defense will go on to point out that they did indeed already have Edwards' DNA in the lab due to the rape, so there was a possibility that they could have cross-contaminated it with Kira's fingernail samples. However, the prosecution countered with several scientists that were able to state that those samples were stored separately in their own separate containers in completely different parts of the pathology department and had not been cross-contaminated. The prosecution was able to point to a critical 98 fibers that linked Edwards and his vehicle to both Kira and Jane's murders, as well as linked it back to the cemetery rape. With these fibers, they were able to present to the court that they had full faith that Kira and Jane had been in Edwards' car before their death. The defense team had gotten their own fiber experts, but in the end, decided not to present their findings to the court. Prosecution also had witnesses that saw Edwards in the Telstar vehicle that matched the description of the vehicles that were seen in the Claremont and Caudesal areas the night that both Jane, Sarah, and Kira disappeared. The prosecution called living witnesses. These young women were able to detail nights when they were trying to get home in the Claremont and Caudesal area where a man matching Edwards' description, driving a white vehicle that looked like a car or a van, stopped and offered them rides home. The defense counterargument was that that proved absolutely nothing as far as it being Edwards, and in fact could point to a potential other predator that is still out there. The prosecution would then go on to point out that Edwards had a proven record of unprovoked violence towards females, and this would show that he was more likely to have committed these murders. They presented the three cases that they knew they had him on, and the two that he actually admitted guilt in. The attack in the hospital on Wendy, the social worker, in 1990, the assault of the woman in her own bed in 1988, and the brutal rape of the 17-year-old girl in the cemetery. Miss Barbagello would say, quote, shows that the accused had the ability to be able to subdue, restrain, bind, hood, and gag a victim, carry her and conceal her in his car without the victim being able to scream out, raise the alarm, or defend herself. The accused demonstrated the ability to do this supports the state's contention that he had the requisite skill and ability to subdue and abduct Sarah Spears, Jane Rimmer, Kira Glennon, unquote. Prosecution would also point out that Edwards continuously lied over the past 3 years about his involvement in the rape and the Huntingdale home invasion, only to admit it later. This is also very telling. Now I get to the point of why I want so badly to tell this story. I wanted to tell it for all the victims, every single one of them, but I especially felt so hurt for Sarah because to this day we have never found Sarah's remains. And so getting a conviction on her was going to be the hardest fight this prosecution had ahead of them. Since they didn't have Sarah's remains, they couldn't present DNA evidence and fiber evidence like they had for Jane and Kira. They did, however, have witnesses that stated that the night that Sarah disappeared, they heard screams in Mossman Park. And there are witnesses that did see Sarah on the street that night, approached by a vehicle described similarly to the same vehicles described the night of Jane and Kira's abductions. Prosecution would argue, based on Sarah's build compared to the other girls and just the circumstances surrounding her disappearance, the vulnerability of the situation, and the time of night, that Edwards was most likely the person responsible for her disappearance. I don't like to go into the lives of perpetrators, predators, whatever you want to call them. I don't like to give them airtime or credit, and I'm not someone that is trained to be able to tell you my thoughts or opinions on why I think they did what they did. That's not my job. For me, it's important to get the victim's stories out there. But there is a little side note that they did put out there as to why they believe that Edwards committed these crimes and how they're connected when they happen. It seems as whenever he had an issue with a personal relationship is when he then would go out and act out and abduct or harm these women. They say the night that Sarah disappeared, for example, he had gotten in a fight with his wife who refused to go to a fireworks show with him. So in a state of emotional distress, he would go out and abduct these young women in a way of almost trying to get power back to the situation. The prosecution was able to point to these similar issues in his personal life with relationships correlating to the nights that these women disappeared, were attacked, or raped. But again, this was something that was very hard to prove. The prosecution didn't spend too much time trying to prove this. In my research, I came across a lot of people that go and talk more about Edwards' life growing up and his personal life, how they also believe that these abductions and abuse towards women were his retaliation for the women in his personal life, not doing what he wanted or leaving him in a divorce, etc. So if you're interested in looking into that, there is so much more out there that you can read through. The trial would go on for over 7 months and cost Australia over $11 million. And on September 24th, 2020, Justice Hall delivers his verdict.
Based on those findings, the verdicts will be as follows. Stand up, please, Mr. Edwards. On count six, that on or about the 27th of January 1996 at Claremont and elsewhere, you willfully murdered Sarah Ellen Spears. My verdict is that you are not guilty. On count seven, that on or about the 9th of June 1996 at Claremont and elsewhere, you willfully murdered Jane Louise Rimmer. My verdict is that you are guilty. On count eight, that on or about the 15th of March 1997 at Claremont and elsewhere, you willfully murdered Kira Eilish Glennon. My verdict is that you are guilty. You can sit down.
So as you just heard to Justice Hall, there wasn't enough evidence to convict him on the disappearance of Sarah. It's heart-wrenching for her family. It's heart-wrenching for all the families of the victims because they have all become so close. Not only the families of Jane, Sarah, and Kira close, but the victims and families of the rape, the home invasion, as well as Wendy. So they all grieved for Sarah not getting her justice that day. But her family will not give up. They will continue to fight and do whatever it takes to get Sarah her justice. They are still waiting and hoping that her remains will be found so they can find some peace in her loss. December 23rd, 2020, Edwards would be sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 40 years to be served. If you know Australian court systems or if you've listened to a few cases that I've covered in Australia, they do not believe in what we call life sentence with no parole here. Australia is really about rehabilitation, and they do believe that a person can be rehabilitated. So Edwards must serve a minimum of 40 years before he's available for parole. Here's a clip from the local news station the day of his sentencing.
Stand up, Mr. Edwards. Bradley Robert Edwards, you are sentenced as follows. Life imprisonment to serve 40 years before being eligible for parole.
Trial Judge Stephen Hall made sure the Claremont serial killer paid for his crimes.
I recognise that the sentence I impose will mean that there is a high likelihood that you will die in prison.
However, he rejected a never-to-be-released order that was encouraged by prosecutor Carmel Barbagallo. But the most stunning words that rang across today's packed courtroom came from one of his surviving victims, the teenager who was viciously abducted and raped by the Telstra technician in the Karrakatta Cemetery. Telling Edwards face-to-face, "I hope you get treated as well in prison as well as you treated us. You are a despicable, pathetic coward who preyed on vulnerable young women who didn't stand a chance. You are no evil genius. You are unremarkable, who's just slipped through the cracks." But today, some satisfaction.
What do you think of today's sentence?
Fantastic.
Does it
say that?
Does it provide your family any closure?
A bit, I suppose. Are you disappointed that he wasn't given that non-parole? No, because he'll be about 90 before he gets out, if he ever does.
Are you satisfied with that sentence?
Police Commissioner Chris Dawson was central to this long-running investigation.
Edwards is a killer, a sadistic rapist who preyed on innocent women. It is my sincere hope, for the sake of victims, for the sake of the families and friends, and indeed for the safety of our community, that Edwards will never be released from prison.
But no reaction today from the man at the centre of it all, just like he's maintained since his arrest 4 years ago. No emotion, no expression throughout this $11 million court trial that's been followed by 7 million people worldwide. And today, no further clues to his thoughts, because he has refused to see a psychiatrist or allow a psych report to the judge. At 52 years of age, he'll almost certainly die in prison.
Edwards had the opportunity to appeal his charges. The deadline was February 4th, 2021, and the deadline came and went. It seems as if Edwards has no plan to appeal his sentencing. The West Australian Police pointed out in a statement that they are determined to continue the investigation into Sarah Spears' disappearance. They are not done trying to seek answers for Sarah and her family. This case is so much more massive than I felt like I could cover in one or two episodes. Honestly, this case deserves its own dedicated podcast because there is so much more to this case. There are people that believe there are many more victims out there that just haven't been connected. I had to choose what I felt like was important to tell you guys for you to just get the basic understandings of this massive case. There are some amazing documentaries on this case that go into the investigation more, into Edward's past as well, as much more detail about the trial. However, my focus was and will always be on the victims. I will be watching and waiting for the day that they announce a new trial for Sarah, because it angers me that he was acquitted for her murder. Hopefully, I'll be back with a new episode dedicated to Sarah. My heart goes out to her loved ones. I know this was a long one, so thanks for sticking in there. I have put up links on my Sipping on Some Crime page so you can go and research this story for yourself, and also links to the documentaries that you can watch about this case. I definitely encourage you, if you are interested in this story, to take a deeper dive. And don't forget, every time you see those missing and murdered posts, to like, share, retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.